Good afternoon. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Glad you could join us. Well, Monday is our time to do all things political, and that's what we'll do this hour. We'll talk about the latest political news across the country. You are certainly welcome to join the conversation at 800-486-8655 or talk at WPR.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn program on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. My guest is Ronald Brown, professor of political science at Wayne State University in Detroit. Professor Brown, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn program.
Thank you, John. I'm happy to be here today.
Well, I'm glad you're here, too, because it would be a heck of a boring show if it was just me for an hour. You're in Detroit. Let's start by talking about Detroit's money woes. Over the weekend, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew says Detroit won't be getting a federal bailout, although he did indicate repeatedly that the Obama administration stands with the people of Detroit. Hard to figure out exactly what he meant by that.
Well, I think what he meant by that is that the Department of Housing will assist Detroit in trying to coordinate more money to demolish housing. Maybe the Department of Transportation will assist Detroit in trying to obtain more money to improve its bus system. So just more discussion and talk about how to help to alleviate Detroit. I think Obama gave a speech over the weekend about the middle class, and he didn't mention Detroit, nor did he mention poor people in Detroit. So I think that Obama administration, I think they're trying to say hands off on the city, since they see it as a state/city problem.
Yeah, some people are drawing parallels between Detroit's situation and when the federal government decided it was a good idea to bail out the automakers. Are those parallels valid, do you think?
I think they're somewhat different, and different in the sense that Detroit has, on a very positive note, Detroit has been trying, I think, for years, trying to address this question of deficit. The fact that there wasn't enough money in the budget, but because of the lack of trust, I think, between state officials, city officials, lack of dialogue between the larger corporate sector in the Detroit metropolitan area, this problem continued just to go on and on and on. And so I think, and the other difference, I think, is that there's a lot of political weight involved. The majority of the unions in Detroit are Democrat. The administration is Democrat. So I think politics and partisanship played a much more positive role. General Motors, for example, it was an international corporation, and so it was more discussion about the impact of letting GM go down and the national economy. Detroit is more about the region and the state. So I think that made them somewhat different.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the situation in Detroit. I think for most of us, what we know about Detroit is that it's the home of the Tigers and the Red Wings and the Pistons, and that's where cars are made, and that's probably about the extent of it. But you've seen a dramatic drop in population there in Detroit, and there's some pretty awful things going on there.
Well, I think I'm going to try with the positive stuff first and then go to the negative negative things. What's positive about Detroit is that a year ago, a new city charter was passed. And in that charter, there's room for a board of ethics. And that ethics board is to root out all corruption in the city, to make sure that your friends, your relatives do not get contracts without transparency. The charter also has – we moved from at-large to districts in terms of electing members to the council. And so now there has been an attempt to improve democracy at the grassroots level in the city. The positive part about the city is that there are numerous grassroots block clubs, city clubs in the city, trying to address problems at the neighborhood level. That's very, very positive. Wayne State, we're in Detroit. Michigan, Michigan State, we're all downtown Detroit trying to improve the services that people receive, restoring hope for people that have lost it. And there are many young Americans moving back into the city. And that's the positive part. I think that the negative part is the fact that the city is poor. I mean, it is true, the city is poor, and the people that could not get out of the city because of lack of education or lack of skills remain in the city, and I think that is the issue.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, people are saying, well, you know, you have all these union workers out there that you gave these great deals to, and now you have to pay for it, you know, good luck with that.
Well, the city tried, being the administration tried to renegotiate some of the pension benefits that were going to, I think police union workers, and they lost. And they were told that you cannot renegotiate this contract. And so the vast majority saw that the city was trying to cut back, but it couldn't do it because of they lost this battle in the courts.
Mm-hmm.
What also has occurred in the city of Detroit is that Kevin Orr was appointed as emergency manager, city workers took big cuts. I mean, they took a 10% pay cut. Overtime has been drastically reduced. There have been massive layoffs of city workers, and so that the city workers have taken pretty big hits in terms of trying to reduce the amount of pay that they could give to individuals. And at the same time, with reduction in the workforce, service delivery also goes down. So this idea about police calls having long waits for police calls, buses not being on time. A lot of that is also because of the lack of personnel. And number two, I think that this problem, because it's been so long in the working, it's not going to resolve beyond the bankruptcy. I mean, this could take 5, 10, 15 years trying to get the city back on its feet again.
We're talking, it's All Things Political today on the Kathleen Dunn Program. I'm John Munson. My guest is Ronald Brown, professor of political science at Wayne State University in Detroit. And, of course, one of the pieces of political news is the fact that the city of Detroit has declared a Chapter 9 bankruptcy. There was some discussion on that over the weekend on a number of the political talk shows on television and, of course, all over on the web, a lot of stuff here that we can delve into today. I don't want this to be the only topic we take up this hour, and we've got some calls about this, so I'd like to get those now. We'll go to Charlie in Milwaukee first. Charlie, good afternoon. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much. I was for several years, I was at the University of Michigan, and I got to tell you, 15 years ago, everybody knew that there was corruption in Detroit, that things were on a downward spiral, and they knew what the problems were. They knew that there was corruption. They knew everything that was eventually going to happen, which is happening now. So, I mean, this is truly Detroit's problem, and Detroit has to fix it. Because if they don't, then it becomes, why not have every city offer lavish contracts and then eventually just declare bankruptcy and have the government, federal government, bail them out? We need sensible, honest government, and the only way you're going to do that is to have people realize that there's a risk if you're going to go the other way with dishonesty and corruption. Thank you.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Professor?
In terms of corruption, the former mayor of the city of Detroit, Kwame Kilpatrick, was convicted of federal corruption charges, and he is now serving time for that. The charter does. I mean, the new city charter has a board of ethics with annual meetings scheduled, so the public can know in terms about contracts, who has contracts, the bids, the process. So there is an attempt now, in the new charter, to address these questions of corruption in terms of the city. So that's number one. In terms of union contracts, what occurred is that the city of Detroit is, ironically, the only employer of many workers in the city. The corporations are not there anymore, so there aren't that many large corporate jobs available. You have small entrepreneurial companies that are in Detroit now. And so one of the reasons for, I think, in terms of the unions is that it is the contract for the majority of workers who reside in the city. And very shortly, the reason why it is because, again, that it was in the 50s and 60s one of the only places where African-Americans could obtain jobs, could obtain high-paying jobs. While you have them in the corporations, the city became, you know, the employer for the vast majority of those workers, ironically starting in the late 50s, going into the 60s and 70s.
Charlie, thanks for your call. Let's take another quick call before we go to break here. We'll go to Green Bay next, and Saeed is on the phone with us. Saeed, good afternoon. Thanks for joining me.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. What the problem in Detroit is what happens when you have a single-party system. The only people driving the bus in Detroit since 1957 have been union bosses and liberal Democrats. And just like Margaret Thatcher said, eventually socialists will run out of other people's money to spend. This is not just a problem of Detroit, though. This is a warning to the rest of America, because we are headed the same way that Detroit has gone. Irresponsible fiscal management has led them to where they are. There has been not a single, there has been only one Republican councilman elected since 1957. The unions, even in the Obama bailout of the auto industry, the unions were treated with kid gloves and made to sacrifice nothing. This has got to stop. These unions have resulted in the production leaving the states, in right-to-work states. The comparable salaries and benefits are exactly half of what these folks have negotiated for themselves, and now the rubber meets the road. To ask for any sort of federal help here, why should Wisconsin citizens pay tax that goes into supporting that sort of irresponsible fiscal management?
So, thanks for the call, Professor.
One reason why there's been, Saeed said, a one-party system since 1957. It's because of white flight, and so what you left, what was left in the city were Democrats, and so you had Democrats who were left largely in Detroit, and also Detroit and its relationship to Macomb County, to other cities, were in competition with each other, in competition for sports stadiums, in competition for corporations that would come, and that competition resulted in the suburbs doing extremely well in terms of attracting corporate jobs, entrepreneurs, and the city not attracting that. And a lot of that, you know, goes back to cities competing with each other for scarce resources and the city losing. And that could account to why you have a poor city and a city of Democrats. And in terms of the private public, I mean, we're talking, Detroit has public unions. We're talking about public unions as opposed to UAW, which is a private union. So that, and the workers in Detroit, I mean, for example, we're talking about the fact that the pension, $19,000 or $26,000 in terms of what these workers would receive if indeed they obtain their pension. Taxes. The city residents pay, I mean, the city residents in Detroit are paying one of the highest taxes in the state for services. So their tax rate is much higher than cities in the state. And so the residents themselves, those who have stayed, have opted to stay and to pay a higher tax rate for services. And so it's not that people are sitting on their hands. It is a massive problem. And Saeed is somewhat correct. There should be cooperation and discussion, but that arrow goes both ways.
Mm-hmm. Saeed, thanks for the call. Let's take one more call on this topic, and then I'd like to expand the discussion a little bit because there's some other related news on this that, Professor, I'd like to get your take on as well. Let's go to Kim in Racine next. Kim, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. Thank you for this program, and thank you to Ronald Brown.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I'm hearing callers call in. I'm hearing they need to do. You know, so often... cities, states, people don't want government involvement. Then when there's problems, they want federal assistance. However, there have been such massive layoffs in all areas of work in Detroit. How does the average person fight corruption?
Kim, I think we lost you.
But they raise their kids.
Okay, Kim, we lost you for just a second. Could you repeat your question again, please?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Well, the thing that I'm wondering about is how everybody's saying, well, they need to put these so-and-so in office, and they're not doing what they should be doing. Well, the whole thing is you've got a lot of people who are just trying to put food on the table and raise their families. How does the average person fight corrupt people in office? It's very different for the average person. First of all, people don't always have the truth. They don't always know what's going on, which is important to get involved. But to keep their city safe, to keep this kind of thing from happening again, how does the average person get involved? What can the average person do to fight corruption? How is that possible? Because that's what it comes down to, because those are the people inevitably who get hurt the most by this.
Okay, Kim, thanks so much for that. Professor?
Okay, Kim, what we're trying to do in Detroit, I've been involved with Sheila Cockrell and Irv Reed. Sheila Cockrell is an ex-city council member, and Irv Reed is the one of the past presidents of Wayne State. And Sheila and Irv have this group called Citizen Detroit. And what I've been doing with them is running workshops. And what we've done for the past year is to run a number of workshops with voters from different districts, trying to educate them about the city in terms of its crisis it faces, in terms of the debt, in terms of do we pay for lighting, do we pay for sewage, what do we pay for? And so what we're trying to do over the past year is to have these workshops, trying to educate citizens, and so that they can ask, for example, Kevin Orr a question, or ask, we're having a primary election, to ask the candidates who are running for the mayorship questions about the city, the relationship with Kevin Orr. So we're trying to very, very slowly educate citizens about how do you become responsible yourself and not passive aggressive.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to expand the discussion a little bit, because there are other cities that have similar circumstances, or at least, there are other cities that have similar circumstances to Detroit. What can be learned? We can talk about some of that. Also, a lot of other political topics to discuss this hour as well. It's the final days of the 113th Congress before its summer recess. We can speculate a bit on whether or not action is going to be taken on student loan interest rates, immigration, or the debt ceiling. And in terms of immigration, Congressman Ryan from Wisconsin had some interesting comments. We'll get to that. There's been some discussion on the debt ceiling and a warning from President Obama's new Treasury Secretary not to play politics with it. And then later on in the hour, we're going to talk about the backlash against the NSA. A new Pew Research Center survey released on Friday found that for the first time, Americans are more concerned about their civil liberties than national security. We'll discuss the ramifications of all of that. Ronald Brown is my guest. He's professor of political science at Wayne State University in Detroit. It's All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Well, national parks on the moon? It could happen. Today at 4 on Central Time, Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickard find out how. That's today at 4 o'clock on Central Time. This hour, it's All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn program. Ronald Brown is joining me. He's a professor of political science at Wayne State University in Detroit. And, Professor, we talked a lot about the situation in Detroit. And one thing that I saw just in the last couple of days is that there's been something similar sort of going on in Chicago. Mayor Rahm Emanuel has asked pensioned workers to, instead of getting the health plan that the city had promised them when they negotiated their contract back before they retired, that they should they should be in the insurance exchanges under Obamacare instead. And that's probably going to go to court. Now, you were talking about something that happened in Detroit where the city actually lost a case where they wanted to renegotiate the health benefits for retired workers. What do you think is going to happen with the situation in Chicago?
Well, I think that if Chicago and Detroit are parallel, if they both go to bankruptcy court, then I think all deals are off the table, because then the federal judge or judges can determine exactly what can happen in terms of the obligations that cities have. So I think that in both cities, the workers may find themselves having to go to health exchange programs to get health care. The challenge is going to be that will the quality of the care be the same? And what happens if there's a gap? What happens if indeed the city, if there's a gap between the coverage you have now and the bills that you have to pay?
Mm-hmm. So what happens, though, now as the cities try to recruit new workers? So you come in and they say, well, you know, here's what you get, and these benefits are all part of your package, and when you retire, this is what you can expect. And then later on, after you've worked for however many years it is, you retire, and then they say, oops, well, you know what? Gee whiz, we're out of money. You're out of luck. Go someplace else and find help.
How are they going to do what Caterpillar did, I think, in Illinois, and I think General Motors did, have a two-tier structure. So older workers, those who came in will receive certain benefits. Those who come in 2013 will not. And mm-hmm. So they clearly tell them that we're not going to have a pension for you. You're going to have to invest in the private market. You're going to pay more for your health care. And so that may happen. Or they may go to contract workers, not have full-time workers, go to contractual workers, and then you're obligated to pay any of their health care work. Mm. So you have a smaller full-time workforce, and you have a larger contractual workforce.
Well, some people have concerns then over the quality of the workers in those cases. It's going to just be a lot more difficult to recruit the kind of people you really want to have perform those tasks.
I think that is a valid concern. But cities, if you are the mayor or the council of a city, and you have Chicago and Detroit, and you had decreasing revenues, and you receive information from the Obama administration, we're not going to bail you out. And there are today the coverage of Detroit is all negative. There isn't any money going to come. There isn't any money coming from the federal government to bail you out.
Mm-hmm.
Taxpayers at the state level may not want to pay more state taxes or give more revenue to cities. And so if you're the mayor or the council member, you may be forced to tell city workers to bite the bullet.
Wow.
It's not fair. I mean, it may not be fair and just, but it may be the kind of bitter pill that everyone that you're forced to swallow to obtain the services. And what if we say something even more radical than that, and which is to move not from cities but to regional structures, which was discussed years ago.
There are some states that are facing some pretty good deficits in terms of their pension plans. Wisconsin's not one of them, by the way.
Okay.
The Wisconsin plan is pretty much paid for because it's just been set up differently here, and the people doing the investing have done a pretty darn good job. So Wisconsin's not in that position. But Illinois, for example, is the whole state. And there are stories out there that we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars that states and municipalities don't have to pay obligations that they are contractually obligated to pay. At what point does this become a community problem, the community being the whole country? Or is this just, well, you know what, you made the mess, go clean it up, and if people end up being poor as a result, I guess that's just too bad.
Well, John, I think this is a I'll go back and contradict myself. I think this is a national issue. I mean, once it spreads beyond Chicago and Detroit and other cities across the country, and particularly cities that are, people could consider mainly Democratic cities, but to Republican cities also, and becomes a national problem, a national swell in terms of no one is realizing the American dream. Then maybe there will be pressure placed on Congress, on the Treasury, on whomever is occupying the White House to address this large problem about what do you do about these promises and obligations that you gave to workers, and now you can't.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. I think that it may have to come from the bottom up in terms of cities across the country feeling the same type of fate, having the same kind of fate that Detroit's facing, that Chicago is facing. Then I think maybe we'll get a national dialogue and discussion about this.
800-486-8655. If you've got a political topic you'd like to raise this hour, feel free to do so. 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. Well, speaking of Congress, it's the final legislative days of the 113th Congress before their summer recess, still on the table, looking for action. Student loan interest rates, still haven't done anything with that. There's still immigration reform sitting out there waiting to be dealt with, and we're also approaching another deadline for increasing the debt ceiling. And we heard from President Obama's Secretary of the Treasury over the weekend saying, hey, look, you got to stop playing chicken with this because it disturbs the markets and it damages the economy. But Professor, if we look if recent history is any guide, there are a number of people in Congress who are basically going to say, so what? Do it.
Well, the reason they can say so what, one reason why they may say so what, do it, is the way the way we have our districts, many of these members are safe. And they may feel that, indeed, they can keep playing chicken because they will not face any type of real election challenge within their districts. And so they can say, let's play chicken. I think that's why President Obama gave a large speech in Galesburg, Illinois, arguing that we have to put pressure on members in Congress to do something about the debt ceiling, about immigration reform, about the American dream. And so he wants us to put pressure on members of Congress, and maybe then the Congress will act. The challenge is that many of these districts are so safe that Congress may decide to wait until they're able to get the deal, that the House will wait until it gets the deal that it wants.
Well, they've said that they want big cuts in non-defense discretionary spending.
Right.
By the Republican members of the House have said they want big cuts in non-discretionary federal spending before they'll agree to any other appropriations bills and presumably increases in the debt ceiling, which, by the way, is what? I mean, when we talk about increasing the debt ceiling, aren't we just saying we have agreed to pay the bills for things we've already said we're spending money on?
We have. And also, I think what that means also is that if indeed they want cuts across non-defense programs, it's going to be impossible for cities such as Detroit and Chicago to receive any type of assistance to help them to deal with these pressing problems and so that. And I think also that it means also that the degree to which senior citizens and others are feeling the pain of not receiving services, I think Obama wants, again, citizens to put pressure on their members to state that the debt ceiling is not abstract. I'm feeling the impact because I'm not getting the kind of services or assistance that I think I should receive. It means, for example, I think for us at Wayne State University, that some students may be delayed in terms of their financial aid, or we may have less money to give the students at Wayne State. So there'll be more pressure on us to decide who to fund and not to fund. So I think there are consequences that will, in terms of these cuts, continuing across the board.
Mm-hmm. 800-486-8655. Matt is with us in Eau Claire. Let's take Matt's call. Matt, good afternoon.
Yes. Hello. Hi. Well,
yeah.
I just wanted to make the comment. I mean, cities, states like Detroit, Illinois, and Chicago, they had their economic growth on borrowed time by, not raising taxes or not spending in previous times. And, now it's time, why should Wisconsin, taxpayers have to, foot the bill, quote unquote, bail out their neighbors and, I mean, you know, Janesville, Kenosha, Racine, those areas were hard hit, and they were hard hit, and they didn't get a bailout from anybody, at least on the government side. And, you know, it's maybe it's Wisconsin's turn, those areas' turns to kind of, you know, have a little economic prosperity. And why should they sacrifice it for the expense of bailing out, you know, citizens of Chicago to keep electing these, you know, Democrats that give, you know, free goodies to their, you know, to the unions? It's just, I just think it's chasing good money after bad and continually bailing everybody out. I think everybody kind of had a bailout culture. So that's about it.
Matt, thanks. Thanks for the call. Do you think the problems here can all be laid at the feet of Democrats handing out freebies?
I think John, was that Matt who just spoke on the
yes.
phone? Yes. One factor is that the union membership in this country, both private and public, has been declining over time. And so, while we have this idea that unions are huge, the membership in unions has been declining over time. So they aren't as large and as powerful as we think they are. So I think, you know, that's one issue that we ought to think about. I think also in terms of balancing taxes, I don't know what the tax rate is of citizens in the city of Chicago, but I'll say what I said earlier. Detroit city residents pay a higher tax rate, a higher city tax, than do non-Detroit residents. So when you compare the tax rate of citizens in the city of Detroit in comparison to its sister cities, the rate is higher. So citizens in these cities, particularly in Detroit, are paying taxes to try to obtain services. There just isn't enough money available for them. And maybe there should be more dialogue and discussion in terms of being innovative across parties, maybe public-private partnerships. That may help in terms of planning to ensure that cities don't face the kind of shocks that you're facing now. So if there's more public-private dialogue where everyone thinks about the public good, the collective good, that may help cities across the country. And for example, corporations can, whether it be Racine, Wisconsin, Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, can move across the country globally, move out of the country. Many cities give these corporations huge, extensive, some tell them your tax rate is going to be lower, some give them land with very little, almost minimum amount of taxes they have to pay. And the corporations stay, and when they're ready to leave, they'll just leave. And when they leave, these cities are stuck with a huge tax hole where money isn't coming in, and citizens that demand services. And so this idea of public-private partnership where everybody wins, we haven't had that kind of dialogue and discussion in this country, and each city is fighting each other for corporations, and the corporations largely win this fight, have been winning this fight.
800-486-8655, that's the number to call to join us on all things political here in the Kathleen Dunn program. Let's talk about some other stuff related to Congress. The latest polls indicate that public opinion about the job that Congress is doing is at an all-time low. Although I think if you survey the same people about the job their person who represents them in Congress is doing, you probably get a different answer, which is nothing new. We've always thought, okay, the problem with Congress is everybody else's member of Congress. Our person is doing okay. Everybody else's person is the problem. Is there anything in this? I mean, can we expect this kind of public opinion to actually have any effect on individual members of Congress? Because it just seems like it doesn't.
Might, John, it might, in terms of your earlier question about if indeed all Americans begin to feel at the pinch of not having their highways, not having snow delays and not enough money, and the highways having potholes and expressways across the country, having longer lines, and this has been solved, but longer lines in airports, federal parks, having problems in terms of not having enough park rangers or polar grass in federal parks. And so the amenities that we assume that we have, that we expect to have, if these things start to decline, then that might make all of us rethink about this social contract that we have, you know, with the federal government. And I think that might lead to some people thinking about what's the relationship between myself, my member in Congress, and the type of amenities that I assume I should have as an American citizen, whether it be highways, the rail system, parks. I think that is that might move us to rethink about the type of government we have and what we expect from our members in Congress.
Mm-hmm. 800-486-8655. I tell you what, let's take a short break. We come back. We've got some callers who want to join us. Still to come, I want to make sure we get into this because it leads nicely into the topic we'll be talking about after 2 o'clock this afternoon. There has been kind of a shift in public opinion about how we feel about our civil liberties and some backlash against the National Security Agency. A new Pew Research Center survey released last Friday found that for the first time, Americans are more concerned about their civil liberties than national security when it comes to the practices of the NSA. We'll talk about that and some other things as well, things that you might bring up at 800-486-8655, talk at WPR.org or on Facebook. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Be sure to stick with us because next hour we'll be joined by the filmmaker of a new documentary that exposes what corporations and the government learn about people through the Internet and even through your cell phone usage and what can be done about it, if anything. Big topic next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's all things political. My guest is Ronald Brown, professor of political science at Wayne State University in Detroit. And professor, as I mentioned before the break, there's been a new piece of research that's come out from the Pew Research Center suggesting that for the first time, and I don't know if that means first time since 9/11 or just first time ever, Americans are more concerned about their civil liberties than they are about national security when it comes to the practices of the National Security Agency. I just wanted to get your take on that.
This reminds me of, John, of the 1970s, and I'm old enough to remember the Nixon administration. I think it was the Church Commission in terms of wiretapping and the impingement upon civil liberties at that time and Congress restrictions on the ability of the federal government to impinge upon the private liberties, the personal liberties of Americans. And so this may be the first time, I think you're right, John, since 9/11, but Americans have always been concerned about this question of how do you balance personal liberty with national security. And right now, in this current era, it's the NSA, but years ago in the 70s, it was with telephones, it was wiretapping and listening on the telephone conversations of American citizens and of Democrats. And so I think that we've always tried to balance both.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the things, in fact, we'll hear about this next hour in our program, in this new documentary that's just out. One of the things that we're learning about now is that the Fourth Amendment really doesn't mean much in the digital age, because once you give your information to a third party, they can pretty much do whatever they want with it.
Right. I mean, what we're getting right now also is that many third parties, for example, I think AT&T. I got something in the mail the other day saying that they will share their information with third parties, and they're letting us know what exactly they're sharing with third parties.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of frightening to think about the fact that our information can be looked at, can be gleaned by federal agencies, and the fact that the NSA has been doing this and us not knowing it is, I think, problematic in terms of this issue of privacy, because we do not want to, I think, surrender executive power, like give the president, whomever that is, the person, that type of power, because there isn't any guarantee that after we're at peace that there will be a retraction of the surveillance that we have by the federal government, by the NSA or by other federal agencies. And so I think it is important that we largely ensure that there is transparency at the federal level, too, in terms of the rationale and the reason why they want to examine our private information.
Well, and there now seems to be some momentum in Congress for reining in the National Security Agency, and it's brought together some rather strange political bedfellows, to say the least, Democrats and Republicans on both ends of the spectrum from right to left, and including a congressman from your home state of Michigan who want to change things. In fact, there was a vote in Congress just last week, and it almost went against the NSA. Very, very close vote, and there does seem to be some momentum to change this. What do you see happening in Congress, if anything?
I do think there will be restriction on the NSA in terms of the criterion that this agency has to use in terms of its examining our phone records, our internet action. So I think there will be some restrictions at the margins with that. But I do think that they will continue to, if they think there is a reasonable suspicion, to track the information of American citizens. So I think that's linked also to this idea that the war on terror is ongoing and is never ending, and there isn't a date in sight. So I think that there will be some curtailing of that, and there will be more more transparency. However, I think there will continue to be tracking of American citizens if indeed the argument is that we have to do this for national security purposes.
800-486-8655. What do you think about the information that's being gathered on American citizens by the National Security Agency? It's one of the topics under discussion today on All Things Political here on the Kathleen Dunn Program. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen this week. My guest is Ronald Brown, professor of political science at Wayne State University in Detroit. Again, 800-486-8655. You can also reach us via email, talk@wpr.org, or leave a comment on Facebook. Well, a lot of people still want to talk about what's going on in our cities, and let's take a few of those calls. Let's go to Dan in Chicago. Dan, go ahead.
Hi, I'm just happen to be driving through, and I'm listening to your show. Let me tell you about Chicago. You know, back in 1974, you know, everybody holds up this Richard J. Daley as some great mayor of Chicago. Well, he came up with this greedy scheme that he was going to charge everybody in the city. If you hired someone, he wanted you to pay a tax of $5 per employee per month if you had more than 15 employees. Well, do you know that he drove 400,000 manufacturing jobs out of Chicago? Now, Chicago has been fortunate that a lot of these, there's been a great increase of residents that have covered some of this. But if you're not manufacturing, the wealth of the nation, just like in Detroit, it was taxing schemes in Detroit that drove most of the manufacturers out. Because if you go into the suburbs, they're still manufacturing cars there, but I don't think they manufacture any one car in Detroit. They avoided the taxes. In Chicago, they just left totally, or they went out to the suburbs or other towns or other. I mean, how many companies left Chicago and came to Milwaukee? Because maybe your taxing strategy was not as offensive to, someone building a company, hiring people, giving people a great life, giving people great jobs, and then the politicians want to come in and look for their bribery or want to look for their. I mean, I give you a quick example right now. The air show going to Oshkosh, I'll be up there Wednesday. Did you know the Obama administration charged them almost $500,000 in order for them to put their event on? So you want to talk about taxes destroying things, that's what taxes will do.
Dan, thanks for the call. Professor?
What Dan is tapping into has been as long up. It's part of the American culture. I mean, this whole anti-tax phenomenon. What it means to be an American is largely dependent to oppose taxes. I mean, the American Revolution was largely about taxes imposed upon us by the British. And so I think that we've had this long history of opposing any type of taxes that we think impinge upon our economic personal liberty. The last question is, how do we deliver quality of life to citizens who reside in a city, a county, or a state? I mean, how do we, so if we don't tax, if we have minimal business taxes, we have minimal level of taxes for city residents, and minimal state taxes, do we privatize services for everything then? So do we privatize state fair? Do we privatize the air show? Do we privatize services and recreation? Because in theory, the tax dollars that you pay are for a public good. So we sacrifice our the money we earn to provide a larger good to the public. So
mm-hmm.
What's a fair tax base? I think it's a question that we ought to ask ourselves in terms of a fair tax base to receive a fair amount of services.
Sure. Let's see. Let's take a call from James in Magnolia. James, good afternoon.
Thanks for taking my call. And my comment is about the NSA. And, you know, we as Americans with any modicum of common sense sees our government, you know, may have the best intentions with things, but things rarely work out like they get up and tell us they're going to, whether it's supporting a regime change in Egypt to Obamacare. And we have to be suspect because we know where those good intentions have led us so many times, being worse off than if they would have just stayed out of things. And, you know, the Boston bombing and the Fort Hood shooter are two examples of us getting neither security or liberty because they do have all the information, yet a lot of times they don't do anything anyway. Anyway, thank you.
James, thanks so much for the call, warning us to be leery of the law of unintended consequences operating perfectly here.
I think James makes a very good point in terms of not thinking about the consequences of when you give up the type of liberty, as I stated earlier. If once the war of terror is over, how do you rein that back in? And we have to educate citizens about, for example, the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, that where you can go in and there's a lower threshold in terms of obtaining information, obtaining the proper authority to oversee, to examine, someone's behavior. And so that we have to make sure that all of us know about our court system, the secret courts, those that are there. And that may require, I think, a grassroots effort in terms of giving us the information so we can in turn put pressure on members in Congress, put pressure on President Obama and others to ensure that we don't compromise our private safety for national security.
Mm-hmm. Well, that could be a topic for an entire program. And in fact, in the next hour, we're going to talk about what happens to privacy in an age when all of our data is out there and even stuff we think has been deleted hasn't.
Right.
And how we protect ourselves, we'll be talking about that going forward. Professor, about 30 seconds left. What do you think is going to be the big political story this week?
The big political story, good question. I think the big political story this week is going to be the questions that we're covering now in terms of this question about national security, the question about Obama's message that he gave in terms of the middle class, the fact that the middle class is shrinking in this country, and if nothing is done, that indeed this idea about the American dream will not be here for the next generation. So I think Obama's speech that he gave over the weekend was speaking not about for you and I, but speaking about the next generation and that after the next two generations, will they be able to dream about the possibility of being in the middle class? I think that's going to be the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a big discussion, and it's a tough question to answer. But Professor, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon for All Things
thank
Political.
You.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much, John.
Ronald Brown is a professor of political science at Wayne State University in Detroit. He joined us by phone from Detroit, Michigan this afternoon for all things political. I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour of programming on the Ideas Network, and K.P. Whaley for handling on-air production. Still to come on the Kathleen Dunn program, we're going to be talking with a documentary filmmaker about the topic of privacy. That's coming up after 2 o'clock. I think you'll be pretty surprised by what it means when you check that little box saying, I've read the terms and conditions. You may be surprised by what you're agreeing to. That is still to come here on the Kathleen Dunn program. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.